Okay, good chodesh ear, everyone. It's good to be back. Ear is an acronym for, besides Ani Hashem Refecha, it's an acronym for the patriarchs, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Rachel. So the patriarchs who established the prayers, the three prayers, Shacharis, Mincha, and Maariv. So it's very appropriate in the chodesh that we continue with the prayer book. We left off on page 16, before the introduction to the Shema, the small Shema that we say in the introduction to the prayer, for the prayer. So we started out, first we started with the Akedah, and then with a very powerful prayer. And the merit of the Akedah, Hashem should listen to our prayers. In a way, we're like making a confession, Aval, that although we did not accomplish our mission, the knowledge of Hashem did not yet penetrate the world, all 7 to 8 billion people. And of course, whose fault is it? It's our fault. Because if we, the Jewish people, were on the proper level, on the higher level, the way we should be, the way we could be, and the way we should be, we would have already illuminated the whole world. We would have penetrated human consciousness, transformed, revolutionized human consciousness. But nevertheless, we ask Hashem, we are your nation, the people of your covenant, the children of Abraham, your beloved, whom you swore in Mount Moriah, descendants of Isaac, his only son, as Hashem himself in the Akedah told Avram, take your only son, even though Avram had Yishmael, and Avram had remarried later and had other children. But from all his 8 children, he says, he calls Yitzchak his only son, who is bound on the altar, the community of Jacob, your firstborn. What do you mean the firstborn? He was the secondborn. He bought the birthright from Esav, A, and B, as the rabbis say, that from his father he was the firstborn. And the analogy they give is, when you put 2 pebbles in a tube, the pebble that goes in second last, if you turn it around, turn it upside down, it goes out, it exits first. The pebble that went in first exits last. So it's true that Esav was born, there were twins, but Esav was born before Yaakov. Yaakov was holding on, grabbing onto the heels of Esav. But at the root, at the source, it was the sperm from Yitzchak impregnated Rivka first with Yaakov and then with Esav. And because he was the first one to be impregnated, therefore he was the last one to come out. So at the root, at the source, from his father he was the firstborn. From his mother he was the secondborn. See, that's why he calls him his eldest. From your love, the love, you loved Yaakov so much. And not only you loved Yaakov, but you rejoiced in him. You called his name Yisrael. You added a name. You gave him a second name, an elevated name. And also Yeshurun. We find the Jewish people are called Yeshurun, the Bnei Yisrael, which is the name of Yaakov, Yisrael. So Yaakov, in a sense, was given 3 names, Yaakov, Yisrael, and Yeshurun. So we're saying, in contrast to what we said earlier, we learned last time, we said earlier, how all the nations of the world are all nothing to Hashem. All wisdom is nothing. Everything is nothing to Hashem. Because it's all like a drop in the bucket. It's nothing. They're all like flying dust. But we, who have this pure godly soul, we, the nation that Hashem made a covenant with, his chosen people, and we are the descendants of Avram. We have the biological children of Avram, Yitzchak and Yaakov. So therefore, we can turn to Hashem, we can pray to Hashem, and Hashem responds to our prayers. Because every human being that exists really lives with a deep sense of desperation. Deep down inside, people feel a sense of worthlessness, a very acute sense of existential angst. The rabbis say when Hashem created the world was unstable. The world was like shaking. The world was unstable. And every human being feels acutely this instability. There's no stability. And that's why their whole life is one big pursuit of self-obliteration, which takes on different forms. In the olden days, it was idolatry. You obliterated yourself. Today, it could be sexuality, sexual addictions, other addictions, total self-obliteration. Or the obsession with money, where you worship it and you become totally obsessed with it. It's a way of self-obliteration. Because inherently, deep down, every human being feels that I'm worthless, I'm nothing. the whole world was created through, as the Rebbe Rashab explained, the whole world was created through the Tzimtzum, and they sense that it's nothing, that we are nothing. There's no stability. There's no reality. There's no substance. And that's why the whole life is just escapism, running away. It's like acting out. You're acting out that sense of inherent, innate sense of worthlessness, of nothingness, that we're nothing. All the brilliance and all the wisdom and everything, all the accomplishments and all, what happened to all the mighty nations and all the mighty billionaires are gone. There's not even a trace left of them. Footnotes in history of interest only to a historian. Because even when they existed, they were nothing, and they felt that. And that's why this pursuit, this acting out of a life dedicated to total self-obliteration. It's all about money, power. There's nothing. Living for the moment, living in the moment. Today's great ideology is living for the moment. Complete self-obliteration. Total mindlessness, which comes from a very deep, gnawing sense of nihilism, that I am nothing. I'm just a speck in the universe. I'm nothing. I'm nothing, you know. It's meaningless. Life is meaningless. All that matters is have fun. Call yourself a donkey, whatever you want. It doesn't mean anything. Life is meaningless. This comes from an innate sense of nothingness, worthlessness. A Jew, however, it says until the Jewish people received the Torah, the Jews brought stability to the world because the Jews live with a very deep sense of joy. True joy only comes from Hashem. Hashem is joy. Where does a Jew get his self-confidence from? Moide ani. You wake up in the morning, you say, Moide ani. Where's the ani? Where do I get my self-confidence from? It doesn't come from anything external, money, power, fame. The ani, my self-confidence is based on lefanecha, Hashem. It doesn't come from anything external. It comes from the fact that I have literally a piece of the divine essence. A core, divine core and essence is located at the very center of my being. That I'm married to Hashem, have a relationship to Hashem, we have a covenant. That we are the biological children, we have the blood of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob flowing within us. That's what gives me the confidence. This is what gives me my strength. This is what gives me my joy, my inner joy. During the Depression, Jews did not jump out of windows. We suffered a lot worse than Depression. We had Holocaust, pogroms, order de fe, expulsion, extermination. Because our confidence doesn't come from anything external. That freedom, that connection is something we have in the inside. No one could touch that. No one could take it away from us. This is our ancestry. It's not we had a billionaire, that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob were billionaires, which they were, each and every one of them at a certain point in their life. Because their relationship with Hashem. So deep down inside is a very deep sense of serenity, of calm, of joy, of connected with Hashem. This is our claim to fame. This is what gives us courage and strength. This is what gives us the stamina and the energy, not only to survive, but to thrive and to grow and to expand, to continue. This is our motivation. This is why we jump out of bed in the morning. This is the foundation of our day, of our whole life, our whole existence. Aval anachnu, what are we? What are we all about? What is our claim to fame? What is who we are? What is what gives us strength? What drives us? Our raison d'etre is that we are the nation that you made a covenant with. And we are the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What are these two aspects you made a covenant with? And we are the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The idea of a covenant is when two people make a covenant, that although their relationship now is beautiful, but they know there's going to come a time when the relationship will no longer make any sense. They'll fall out of love, they'll have reasons to want to sever the relationship. So you make a pact, you make an oath, you make a covenant that nothing will sever this relationship. Even if there will come a time when this relationship won't even make sense. But you commit yourself, it's a blood pact, you commit yourself that this is it and we're going to stay together no matter what. So what is the idea of Hashem making a pact with us? Because the whole relationship really makes no sense. Hashem has a relationship with us. It's like saying I have a relationship with an animal, I have a relationship with a stone. could you be a king over animals? All your goats are going to say, we coronate you as our king. You're going to put a crown over your head. You're going to sit on a royal throne. You're going to feel like a king. Could you feel a king, be a king over stones, gems, diamonds? I'm a king. There's no relationship. The distance between us and animals and us and diamonds and stones, you can't even compare it to the distance between Hashem and us. It's infinite. So how can Hashem have a relationship with us? We're completely insignificant. So whatever we do should not evoke any response from Hashem. So we coronate Hashem as King of the universe. So we act righteously. Who cares? What relevance does it have? It doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter. It doesn't make sense that it shouldn't matter. But that's a covenant. Hashem made a covenant that even though it makes no sense, this whole relationship makes no sense, but Hashem made a covenant. He bound himself with to us that our service to Hashem is significant to him, will be significant to him, and he will consider it significant. So every slight move of ours, we do the right thing, we overcome a difficulty, we overcome a challenge. It's hard for us to do the right thing. We push ourselves. It's hard for us to overcome a temptation, and we do the right thing. Hashem, it's so meaningful and significant to Hashem, not because inherently it's meaningful and significant, because Hashem made a covenant with us. And therefore, he chose that we should be our service of Hashem, and our lives and what we do should matter and should be significant. And because of this covenant, that's why we turn to Hashem. We have a right to pray to Hashem. Our prayers mean something to Hashem. Hashem responds to our prayers. He listens to our prayers. He's affected by how we feel and how our attitudes and our hope and faith and trust in him. He responds to it only because of that covenant that he made. And that's why we say we are Amcha, your nation. Because you can't be a king over yourself. You can't be a king over your own children. You can only be a king over subjects that are separate from the king. There's a relationship, the king is head and shoulders above his subjects, but they're in the same ballpark. They're both human, they're both in the same ballpark. So there could be a relationship. So of course a king can't be a king over his own princes, his own children, even his own ministers. You have to be king over subjects. So there's some relationship, but there's a distance, there's a separation. So we feel we're separate from Hashem. Although in reality, we're not separate from Hashem. In reality, we're not separate from Hashem at all. So in a way, it's like Hashem being king over himself. Could you be king over yourself? It also makes no sense. But we do feel and sense ourselves as being separate. And although we feel we're separate, and the reality is that we're completely insignificant, but nevertheless, because we feel we're separate, and Hashem made a covenant with us, that our service and our wanting to have a relationship with Hashem, and our crowning Hashem as king, and our subjecting ourselves to Hashem, and bowing down to Hashem, and wanting to open ourselves up to Hashem, connect with Hashem, Hashem responds, and he accepts our coronation, and he cares about our davening, our petitions, and our tefillahs, and that's why we have a right to daven. That's number one. But that's not enough. Because a covenant means that although inherently there's no real relationship, it doesn't make sense. But Hashem made a covenant, he made a pact, that it's a reality. But that would only work, a covenant is a two-way street, if we are truly serving Hashem. But what about when we're not serving Hashem? We're not behaving as we should behave. We're not behaving appropriately. Nevertheless, we're asking of Hashem that he should respond to our prayers and he should respond favorably, even though we don't deserve it, we don't earn it. And it's a two-way street. Sometimes it seems Hashem is not behaving appropriately to his people. He's not fulfilling his promises to us. He's not treating us nicely. We're suffering too much. He's keeping us in exile for too long. It's not right. Will the God of justice not act justly? 3,333 years? He's betrothed to us and he hasn't even kissed us yet, kissed his bride? Is that right to keep your bride waiting for 3,333 years? Your bride who's halishing, who's yearning so much for Hashem, day in, day out, They're busy studying his Torah, doing his mitzvot, giving tzedakah, incredible amounts of tzedakah, yearning for Mashiach, praying for Mashiach, davening, doing whatever they can and beyond, Herculean efforts to intensify, increase holiness and goodness and godliness. Over 5,000 Chabad house, over close to 7,700 Tanyas published in every city in the world. TanyaClass.com. And despite all of that, Hashem never even gave us his first kiss, which is Mashiach, Yishakeinim Menashikas Piyu. That will only happen when Mashiach comes. And we have all the obligations of the marriage, because the Jewish marriage is in two stages. There's the betrothal. In the olden days, it used to be in two different stages. He used to give the ring, but she was still home with her parents preparing for another year. And then they would come together and move in together, and that was the chuppah. So Mount Sinai was the betrothal. Mashiach will be the consummation of the marriage. Betrothal, all you do is you give a ring. There's no kissing, there's no intimacy, no negiah, nothing. Till the chuppah. But in Jewish law, she's 100% married. If God forbid she commits adultery, she loses her life. And the lover also loses his life. So for 3,333 years, we have all the obligations of the marriage, to the extent that 6 million Jews physically lost their life only because we're married to Hashem. The only reason, because we're married to Hashem. There was no other reason to murder 6 million Jews, men, women, and children, 500,000 babies, only because we were Jewish. Our Jewishness is so real. Our marriage to Hashem is so real that it was expressed physically, that 6 million Jews have to lose their lives only because of their relationship with Hashem. So we have all the obligations of being married to Hashem, with zero of the privileges. Hashem didn't even kiss us yet. He's not consummating his marriage. So it's a two-way street. Yes, the Jewish people are not behaving properly, but it seems Hashem is not behaving properly to the Jewish people either. But this is the promise that we make to each other, that Hashem makes a promise that even if we don't behave, and we're not acting appropriately, and we're not living up to our potential, and he's disappointed in us, Hashem made a promise. He still has to bless us, listen to our prayers, answer our prayers, and bless us with everything that's good. And we made a promise that even if it makes no sense, our being in exile 5,781 years, there isn't a rabbi in the world in his worst nightmare could have imagined at this late date in Jewish history that the Jewish people will still be in exile. The Jews were in Egypt for 210 years. The Jews were in Babylonia for 70 years. In the times of the Talmud already, 300 years after the destruction, there was never such an exile. It was so long, lasted 300 years. The rabbi said, "Kol kol akitzin, all the deadlines are over. Mashiach should have been here already. What's going on?" How about today, 1,950 years later, not 300 years later, 1,950 years later, more than half of our existence as a people since Abraham. We're still sitting, we're stuck in this exile. It's not budging an inch. There's no temple, there's no ingathering of the exiles. So despite all of that, despite the Herculean effort of the Jewish people, the seventh generation, and still it seems like Hashem is not doing what Hashem needs to do and must do and should do this moment and bring Mashiach. But we made a promise. We're not going to be deterred. We're not going to be demoralized. We're not going to become discouraged. We will continue to love Hashem and continue to serve Hashem and continue to daven and continue to learn and continue to jump out of bed and wake up in the morning and continue to do mitzvahs and continue to love our fellow Jew and continue to do kindness. So this is a covenant. It's an oath. It's a promise. It's a two-way street. So that's what we say to Hashem. That we are the nation of your covenant, the children of Avraham, who you loved, that you swore at Mount Moriah. Why does he mention Avraham, who is Hashem's lover, who loved Hashem? Mount Moriah was actually a test for Avraham's fear of Hashem. After the Akedah, Hashem says, "Ata yadaiti, now I know, kirele kimata, that you fear Hashem." It was an act of fear, not an act of love, to offer his son as a sacrifice. Why does he say, "You Avram, who loves you, as you swore during the Akedah?" But the answer is very simple. the test of the Akedah was just a test that Avram's love for Hashem wasn't based on his nature. Because Avram was a loving person. Jews by nature are liberal. We're liberal and nice. We like to be kind. We like to do kindness. And maybe Avram just liked to do kindness. He loved kindness. He loved Hashem. He loved people. It was all nature. But the Akedah revealed when suddenly Avram was tested and asked to do something that went contrary to his whole nature, to every fiber of his being and every bone in his body. And not only didn't he hesitate, he didn't even think twice. He jumped up in the morning and did it with such joy and readiness. So that proved, that revealed that all along his service of Hashem, which was primarily love, kindness, achnasas erchim, and love, and he spread the love of Hashem to everyone, that it was not based on his own nature. It was totally pure and divine and godly. It came from an egoless place. It came from a godly place. It didn't come because he was a liberal and nice by nature and kind by nature. So that's why he says the Akedah, that you swore to him by the Akedah, because the Akedah revealed the source of Avram's true love, of Avram's true kindness and his liberalism and his kindness. It was based purely on godliness, on truth, on emes. We are the children of Yitzchak, Yechidah, Hashem calls his only child. Even Avram had 8 children altogether, right? Keturah, he had another 6 from Keturah, and then he had Yishmael. But Hashem tells Avram, take his binchas Yechidah, your only child. Also, he was unique. Yitzchak was unique. He was the only one of the patriarchs that couldn't leave the land of Israel. He was the only one of the patriarchs that Hashem associated his name with him while he was alive. Because he was so holy that even while he was alive, he was confident that he will remain holy. And he was the only one to live the full 180 years. Chai. And when Mashiach will come, it says we're going to say, the Jewish people are going to say to Yitzchak, you are our father. Not Avram and not Yaakov. Because Hashem comes to Avram and to Yaakov and he said, the Jewish people sin. So what's their response? Let them die and Kiddush Hashem and that will atone for their sins. And Yitzchak stood up for the Jewish people. He says, no. He saw them as they are, that they're good. Avram and Yaakov said, let them reveal the deep, the depth of goodness that they have inside of them, which is in the moment of truth, when push comes to shove, when you have to give up your life for Hashem. And that will reveal how the Jewish people are good, and that will be an atonement for their sins. Yitzchak says, no. As they are, redeem them as they are. Don't wait for revealing the deepest depth. They're good as they are, and the Talmud explains the whole dialogue. And when the Jewish people said, Yitzchak, you are our father, because you saw us through and through, and you stood up for us. So Yitzchak is unique. So we are the children of Yitzchak. Sheneka legabim mizbeach. He was tied. He asked to be tied. This was Yitzchak's idea, because he was worried that human instinct, when his father, when the blade will come down, he'll defend himself. He won't be able to help himself. And therefore, it'll be a defective sacrifice. So he sacrificed himself, and he asked to be tied. So this heroism, this courage, this total dedication to Hashem, the willingness to completely give up, make the ultimate sacrifice for Hashem, this was epitomized by Yitzchak. We inherited from Yitzchak. We are his children. And we are the congregation of Yaakov, Bincha Bechedecha, your oldest child. Because he bought the birthright, and also because he just revealed, by buying the birthright, he just revealed that in truth, he was really the firstborn. Because at the root, at the source, Yaakov is much more powerful than Esav. It appears to be that Esav is the firstborn. Esav is more powerful than Yaakov. The attraction to materialism seems to be a lot more powerful and overwhelming than the attraction to spirituality and godliness. The godly soul represented by Yaakov appears to be this whispering, edel, fine, whispering little voice of conscience that you can barely hear, versus the Esav represents the animal soul, represents all the guns blazing, glaringly loud, powerful. It's all around. Materialism is all around us. So it appears that Esav won the battle before it even starts. And he gets a 13-year head start. You know, Yaakov, the Jew, the godly soul, doesn't make an appearance. He makes an appearance 13 years late. The Bar Mitzvah, he shows up 13 years later. Oh, now you appear. It's already 13 years late. Esav is entrenched. So it appears that Esav is the firstborn. Yaakov's mission is to reveal, a Jew's mission is to reveal, though, that truly Yaakov is the firstborn. The godly soul is so powerful, so intense and so powerful that it has the power to overwhelm Esav. It's like a little light pushes away a lot of darkness. All it takes, one mitzvah, one neshama, as compared to a candle, doing one mitzvah has the power to put Esav out of business forever. Because our attachment and relationship and connection to spirituality, the truth is much deeper than our superficial attachments to materialism. You see, parents are ready to sacrifice for the education of their children, for values, things that matter to you. You're ready to sacrifice everything. Materialism means nothing. So even though it appears to be, it's like darkness, a lot of darkness. But then you shed a little light and you reveal the truth. A little light just pushes away the darkness because light is substance. Darkness is emptiness, is nothing, is the void. So the godly soul's connection to Hashem, that's core, that's essential, that's real. Our attachments to materialism is superficial. So that's our mission, to reveal that we are truly the firstborn.